powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Bump and Stacy
on Seattle Sports.
Streaming through the Seattle Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Michael Bumpus and Stacy Ross.
Here we go now.
Getting back to the Mariners with Ryan Roland Smith. He joins us now on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline. Hey, Ryan, how's it going?
Doing well, guys. How you doing?
Well, very happy after a Mariners win. Bats finally got hot. Granted, a lot of it came in the 10th, but that's okay. I'll take it. What do you think of Cal just raking at Rogers Center?
Yeah, he crushes there. I love it. It's one of those places, I guarantee you, if a team's struggling or it's like not those good vibes in the clubhouse and you go into a building, you're like, oh, man, I got so many good memories in this place, which they do. And you walk in and it's just one of those comfort zones. So you saw that with Carl Seager in Texas for whatever reason. He loved hitting there. And I love it too, especially after some of those comments from Schneider, their manager, which I find really interesting. I know that, that's kind of summoned a few even Blue Jay fans not super happy with him. People around the league too. And Cal definitely addressed that yesterday.
Yeah, Cal is doing his thing in Toronto. And Ryan, as you know, man, games like yesterday, they do something for the confidence. I was having a conversation with Stacy. I go, they've always known that they could pull off some wins, but this just makes them believe it's real. We've seen it now. We can actually do that. What do you think the conversations are like after a win like that? Or do you feel like because there are some veterans on this squad, they just take it as another win, move on, get ready for Friday?
No, I mean, it's big. It's just more of a sense of a relief, I feel like. Even hearing Scott Servais' voice after the game yesterday, it's like, oh, look, Polanco makes that play, we can take a breath. It's like, oh, man, what's that telling you? It's that feeling of, the team's looking at each other going, what is going on? We're trying to pinpoint exactly what's going on. And then all of a sudden, here we are, 17, the Blue Jays, tie it back up. And you're sitting there going, oh, here we go again. We're 1-1 here. I mean, we've got a guy like Logan Gilbert, absolutely dealing, and all of a sudden can't score many runs. That weight carries a little bit more, and then you got that long flight back to the West Coast right after it, and so you pull away with a win. So it's really important. I still feel like they're still carrying this head scratching thoughts in their head as to what is going on, but yesterday definitely helps.
Hey, Ryan, Julio has had a bit of a slow start to start the season. What have you seen from him at the plate? Are there some silver linings where you like the approach? Does he seem lost? How's his season feel for you so far?
Yeah, it's a tough one. And, the one thing, and I've spoke to you guys about this, is you kind of pay attention to, he's hitting the ball really, really hard. That's great. He's hitting the ball on the ground. Again, the ground ball rate's starting to creep up a little bit. And what I feel like with Julio, when he's starting to struggle, and we saw this once we got to June last year, he starts chasing just a little bit more. Swing and miss rate's the same as last year throughout the whole six-month season. But he starts to chase a little bit more and get pitches that he can't quite handle or put you on the ropes as a pitcher. And then all of a sudden, he starts hitting the ball on the ground again. And so I think that, and I say that all the time. Everyone's like, oh, yeah, but hey, look at the strikeouts. He's punched out a bunch yesterday again. But a lot of that comes from him pressing just a little bit too much and going after pitches that they're not essentially in his wheelhouse. They're not in his absolute crush zone. I think that, like I said, the swing rate goes up, ground ball rate goes up, and that just tells you he's pressing. I think he's going to be okay. It's just one of these ones where he just has to backspin the ball into right center field and go, okay, there it is, and get that big smile at second base and can move on. But it's something that, watching him here right now, it is frustrating. I know he's frustrated as well.
Obviously, the Mariners will lean on their guys like Julio and Cal and Ty and all that stuff. But every now and then, man, there's like a Dylan Moore appearance, and he just does something to this team, sparks his team. Didn't get a hit yesterday, but did get on base. How would you describe the role of a guy like Dylan Moore?
Yeah, it's interesting. And like you said, he's a role player. He's going to come in, fill that void sometimes. I know Perry Hill loves it because he can fill that void, especially when you're talking about, what this team's done defensively, more recently than not compared to what we've seen, kind of the more consistent defense. So, when you have a guy like that, you can slot him in. Everyone knows him. Everyone knows his personality. You know what to expect out of Dylan Moore. And yes, that was great. Look, I mean, again, I'm not sitting here going, hey, the team has to all of a sudden start butting guys over because they can't score runs. There's just some of the little things Dylan Moore did yesterday. you know, just that manufacturing and being that guy who is making some changes. It's a huge bonus when you got guys who you can trust and you know exactly what you're going to get off the bench.
Hey, tell us a bit about what you might be looking forward to in their upcoming series. There's an off day today, and then they're opening one up against Chicago back at T-Mobile.
Yeah, I think, you know, the biggest thing is I want to see Emerson Hancock just have a solid outing. He doesn't have to be great. Just get into that sixth inning and feel really good about that changeup, man. That's his bread and butter. He's got to get to a place where he's really confident, doesn't have to punch out the world, get that weak contact. But the big one, man, on that third day, Luis Castillo, I just want to see him go punch out 10, get back to the top of the strike zone, 97s, 98s, you know, start getting those upper velo numbers. Because we talk about the energy. We talk about from Julio, from, you know, all these guys, man. When you got the ACS staff who's kind of been a little lackluster and really trying to find his groove, and we saw that in May last year. It just puts such a different energy to this team. So, again, I know it's the third game of the series. I get it. But just seeing Luis Castillo get back to dominating, especially being at the top of the strike zone, man, I'm looking forward to that.
Ryan, I almost texted you last night, man, because
– Well, why didn't you? What happened?
You know, because I know you're a busy man. You know, you're watching the game. You got things to do. But I'm watching it, and I'm just looking at these pitchers just go at it, man. I mean, Logan Gilbert had his stuff going. Kikuchi had all his stuff going. Like, how do you watch that? As a pitcher, do you appreciate those battles, or do you just kind of look at it as, all right, I just need these M's to get on base?
Well, yeah, Bump, I'm going to be honest with you. Kikuchi, and look, I say this because he's moved on and he's in a different uniform. One of the most frustrating guys, look, to watch for me. It really is. And I say that with all respect to him. Look, he's figured something out in Toronto and having more success. But he used to drive me nuts watching him pitch last year. Watching him with that heavy fastball, 95, 96, and all of a sudden just start tiptoeing around guys the minute he got on the ropes. Drove me nuts. So watching him pitch yesterday, I'm kind of watching everything go back and forth. I'm looking at this team going, okay, at some point they're going to get to him. But then he was able just to make a couple minute executed pitches that changed his whole game. And I know he didn't get super deep into the game, but I'm watching that. And just from a pitcher standpoint, I just respect that. I'm like, oh, okay, there it is. And it's that those fastballs on the inner half of the plate when you're in tough spots. And then on the flip side, look, Logan Gilbert, he's like my favorite dude in this rotation, yeah, for many reasons. And I had a chance to talk to him just the other day, had a really good chat. And so watching him do his thing, and when he gets the feel for that slider, you're like, oh, man, it's going to be a tough one, especially with these Blue Jays, man, all the damage they did with two strikes. And he's just attacking dudes, you know, with two strikes. So it's good to see. So I can absolutely appreciate it. Love watching pitching, that's for sure. It was a good one yesterday.
You mentioned Logan's your favorite guy in the rotation for a lot of reasons. What are some of those reasons, out of curiosity?
I just like, first of all, he takes ownership. Every time he talks about, he's, I get all these guys do, but he's transparent enough in the sense of he has a tough one, and when you talk to him, he can really dive in and break it down. And there's not this situation where it sounds like he's, oh, well, I just didn't have this today or that today. He's like, no, this is kind of what happened. So I love chatting to him about that. He's always been, you know, obviously good with me off the field when I got questions for him in regards to, you know, some stuff which it can be tough to talk about. And the other part of it is too, I just love his work ethic. I don't think we give him enough appreciation. Look, the guy's 6'6", and the biggest question mark, believe it or not, back in the day was, yeah, he's got great stuff, great extension, everything. Is he going to be able to command the baseball? Is he going to be able to repeat his delivery? And watching him pitch and come up, it's like, again, when you're 6'6", man, it's tough to do. You can look at the Hall of Fame. I mean, it's a classic example. Not many dudes over 6'5", maybe Randy Johnson, that's it. Because pitching is tough when you're that big of a dude. And what I've seen from him from when he first came up, he's kind of quietly suppressed any kind of, you know, inconsistency mechanically at all, like whatsoever. He's just gone about his business and he's just found little ways to keep getting better and better. And then he implements that split last year and he's honest with me talking about, hey, it took him a little bit to be confident with it, to recover from it. I just love watching him pitch, man. You guys like that. And, you know, you guys know when you develop a relationship with someone, you always seem to, you know, root for him much easier as opposed to someone as you guys, the industry you're in. If they kind of give you the cold shoulder, you're like, it's going to be tougher to root for you. But if they're gracious and they're honest and transparent with everything they're trying to get done and give you, you know, a good reason as to what's going to make them successful, man, it's easier to root for those guys.
Yeah, I mean, relationships are everything, especially in our business, right? You talk about Logan and him finding confidence in that splitter, man. He's thrown it 37 times, man. What is it like? Have you ever implemented a new pitch? And when do you get the okay? Is it just when you're at practice? Do you throw it a couple times at the game? Like, walk us through that process, because I can't imagine trying something, a new pitch at that level, and being completely confident in it.
It is so much tougher than people. Everyone's just like, oh, he throws a split now, and that's gonna be the saving grace. No. There's a giant process that comes with that. Now, you know, you talk to Pete Woodworth, and you talk about, you know, Bryce Miller's a little different personality when it comes to implementing that split compared to, Logan Gilbert, for example. Like, Logan was way more, methodical about it and cautious with it, whereas Bryce is just like, you know, literally last year in a bullpen session to Pete was like, hey, man, Logan's got a nasty split. How do I throw one of them? He's like, are you serious? Like, you've got, in 4 days, you've got one of the best lineups you're about to face. Like, let's go, like, you know, dial it in. And so, you know, I think we're saying that with me. I tried to throw a cut fastball back in 2010. And you have to be some baseball expert to, if you go Google 2010 Roland Smith, you see the lack of success. Now, I'm not making excuses whatsoever, but I wasted a whole spring training of trying to get that pitch because I was told, look, you need to throw this pitch in order to have success. Maybe not the case at all, but I tried so hard, man. I just couldn't perfect that pitch at all. Movement was good. Velocity sucked. And so I know how hard that is to master. And watch these guys. It's so impressive, especially, you know, Logan Gilbert, when you're watching him throw that split, how nasty that pitch is. And now Bryce Miller, especially, you know, that's a two-strike pitch. So you're going to have a ton of confidence right out of the gates. And they're doing that. So it's fun to watch.
Hey, I think that a conversation that naturally happens when a team struggles is, oh my God, is the manager doing his job? And it's why one of the questions that Bump and I asked of Ryan Divish the other day was, hey, what have you made of Scott's job to start the season? And what might people not understand about the role of a manager? Ryan, you've got the unique experience of having been both a player and also an analyst and someone covering the team, from the inside and the outside. How has the role of a baseball manager changed over time, and what do you think about the job that Scott's doing?
Well, it's changed out over time since I played. Obviously, as we all know, you know, there's a little bit more of a collaborative when it comes to, you know, simple stuff, putting a lineup together. The analytics, all of a sudden, there's five different people giving their input on certain analytical things. But the one common thing that has never changed is, man, you cannot lose that clubhouse. And that's, I mean, any sport, especially in baseball, when you've got 26 personalities in that clubhouse, a lot of new ones, and all of a sudden, your character is really tested when the team starts struggling. And when you try and force some kind of, you're trying to motivate someone or a team or a group, and you try and stretch to, you know, come out of your shoes and change things, man, you'll get figured out real quick. So I think with Scott Service he's taken criticism before, if you don't remember. I mean, there were some tough times and where the Mariners were struggling and everyone was pointing fingers at him. And I think that, the history shows he does a pretty good job of putting the ship back on the right course. And there's been a couple times like that. Even with a young team, you go back, you know, the 2021 team. I mean, the fact that they got that close with that roster and not even, you know, expecting a whole lot is pretty remarkable. Last year at the break, you look at this team and you're like, man, that ship could have sailed real quick in the wrong direction. And it takes, it's a big part of the leadership that happens and how you, captivate those veteran players. Now, the Mariners have, he's in an interesting situation. You got Mitch Haniger, who knows Scott Service from before the fact he left. And then you got Mitch Garver, who was in a World Series last year. So Mitch Garver's going to have that natural, I don't blame him. Oh, man, with Texas last year, we did this. With Texas last year, we did that because there was success there. And so Scott Service, it's imperative for him, when you talk about those veteran players, from a one-on-one standpoint, not from a team standpoint, but from an individual standpoint, is to obviously have a guy like Mitch Garver's respect. And also have that collaboration with your veteran players. Because, man, this is a tricky... I know they won yesterday, but this is a tricky time because you get to the end of April and all of a sudden you're starting to struggle. You can lose that clubhouse real quick. So, you know, it's a tough job. We all know it. There's such a quick turnover with managers. I think he does a really good job, especially when you talk about the relationship. But this is one of those times he's going to be tested again, that's for sure. And it comes down to his individual relationship with some of those veteran players in there who then hand off the message and the example for the younger players.
He is analyst Ryan Roland-Smith, kind enough to join us on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline. Thanks, Ryan.
No worries, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Ryan.
Let's get to Four Down Territory.
This is Four Down Territory, going inside the game with former Seahawks and Coug wide receiver Michael Bumpus.
First down, Bump. How are Michael Penix and Jaden Daniels alike, and why does one quarterback get their similarity used against him while the other doesn't?
Yeah, this is
I'm so curious about this.
This is a messed up situation.
Okay.
Again, I'm a Coug, but I'm a Michael Penix advocate, and I have been for the last few weeks.
That's true.
Because real recognize real. And we keep hearing about Jaden Daniels. He's a good football player. Over 40 touchdowns, 30 through the air, about, 10 on the ground. But when people are looking to knock somebody, especially Michael Penix, they talk about his injury history. They talk about that game against Michigan. And I don't think you can ignore it either. But then they talk about the receivers that he's been throwing the ball to. Oh, in the Pac-12, he had two All-American type receivers over there. What the heck did Jaden Daniels have over there at LSU? You got Neighbors and Thomas over there. All-American caliber type receivers. Yet nobody talks about that. They just talk about how great Jaden Daniels was for 1 year. Michael Penix has done it twice. He does have All-American type receivers, but no one talks about that with Jaden. Also, Michael Penix had a tougher schedule than LSU. I think they were ranked the eighth toughest schedule, LSU number 14. Michael Penix played in a tougher conference than LSU. I'm not knocking Jaden Daniels. All I'm saying is that when they are evaluating these two guys, you cannot use one argument for one quarterback and ignore that the other quarterback had the same dang thing. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, though, Jaden Daniels will go before Michael Penix, but the more I talk about him, the more I hear people talk about him, the more I think Penix is going to slowly move up in this draft and make a team very happy.
It feels like with Michael Penix, there's a moving of the goalpost of what the issue is. Like, the issue is and fairly should be the injury history.
Yeah.
Just say that's what it
is.
Just say I am concerned about the injuries that he has had to his knees, the injury history that he's had, that he has two healthy seasons. But don't keep moving it to where it's like, well, you got to, in the national championship game, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so he was one of two teams that made it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if his season would have ended with the Sugar Bowl after he throws 430 yards and maybe that pass is completed, it's not knocked down, Texas wins, whatever, then he's drafted higher. So
maybe
he's punished for advancing to a game that Bama and Texas couldn't.
And getting beat by the best defensive line in the game.
Truly. Mm. Yeah, you're right. It's like a moving of the goalpost. Just say it's injuries and leave it at that. Second down. Why was it so important that the Seahawks found a way to keep Tyler Lockett here in Seattle?
It was really important. We just heard some sound from Tyler Lockett, and he just knows who he is. And he's completely fine with it, and he understands his role now. He's been in the game, 9 years, going on 10, I believe. He's only had a few coaches, but he knows that for this team to be successful, he's got to be like the bridge when it comes to the receiver room. I think DK is a more talented receiver, but when it comes to the guy who has the calmest demeanor, who shows up to work every day, not saying DK doesn't, but Lockett is just the elder statesman. He is the Bobby Engram of the Seattle Seahawks right now. Back when I played the game, Bobby was that guy. It's just important to have veterans in that room, that offensive room. You got Tyler Lockett. You're going to have Geno, and you'll sprinkle in. That's probably some guy that I'm missing. That's a veteran that's going to be out there. But then you separate. You get into your playmaker rooms. The receivers lean on Tyler Lockett. And Tyler Lockett doesn't seem like the guy who's going to stand up in front of the room and put together a speech. He's just a guy who's going to say what's on his mind, who's going to give people opportunities, who is going to be the kind of the wide receiver whisperer when it comes to the younger guys. He's just a calming force that I think you need on an offense, especially a new offense with Ryan Grubb over there. It was essential that they got this deal done. I'm happy that they did. Tyler Lockett, go do your thing. Don't get mad at him when he catches the ball and goes down. My man is 30 years old, okay? Leave him alone.
Third down. Who did you doubt at first, but now has you bought in as a starting quarterback in the NFL? I can't wait for this answer.
Yeah, and you know what got me all bought in? Dang X, man. X will get you. X/Twitter.
Yeah.
And this dude's been putting out videos of him, Aaron Rodgers type throws, and rolling out to his left and looking good. I'm looking at Will Levis like, I don't know, man.
Stop.
I might be buying into what you're selling over there, Will Levis. He did put together some good games, man. And I don't know. That's just, he got me. I don't know what it is. I don't know. It's not his personality. I think it's just the way he's trying new things. He had some great games as a Titan last year. Who knows what they do in the draft? I don't think they're going to draft a quarterback. They've done that 2 years in a row already. I'm looking at Will Levis. I'm saying, look, man, if you can tap into anything that you did last year, you have a division that isn't wide open. You got the Texans who are favored to win him, but you got young quarterbacks in that division. You got CJ, you got Anthony Richardson, you got Trevor Lawrence, and possibly Will Levis. So, yeah, man, it's weird. Sometimes you just get attached, and you don't really know why. And to me, I think it was the videos that I've seen on X/Twitter.
That is so not. I was racking my mind trying to think of the possible names that it could be, and Will Levis was not even top 10, but not even close. Fourth down. What's a running back combination you're looking forward to seeing next year?
We've been known to be attached to the Baltimore Ravens.
Yeah.
It's going to sound like I'm attached to the Tennessee Titans because I want to see Tony Pollard and Spears go 1-2 next year. Tony Pollard getting a fresh start over there with the Tennessee Titans. And then you have Spears, the more scat back, a guy that they doubted coming into the league because of his ACL type of stuff. So, no, I think they're going to run the football, obviously, because you have Will Levis over there. I think he can toss the rock as well. They're probably going to go get a receiver in this draft. You still got Treylon Burks over there who hasn't worked out from Arkansas at that wide receiver spot, but AJ's gone. Maybe he blossoms a little bit. The Titans are becoming an intriguing team for me. You make a move at the head coach spot. You got a new GM a couple years ago. You see them trying. So because I see them trying, I'm intrigued. I see them trying. I see Will Levis at the quarterback spot. I'm looking at Tony and Spears and saying that could be a deadly 1-2 combo. I think they're going to draft a receiver. I don't know. Tennessee might be last year's Houston Texans for me. The secret's out on the Houston Texans, okay?
Yeah.
Now I'm done with them. This year, I'm staying in the division, and I'm going to be looking at the Tennessee Titans.
Man, I love this topic. I'm trying to now think of a team that could go the opposite route, like a team that's going to kind of fade into the background that everyone thinks might really be good. I mean, it was the Bengals last year, but it was because they had Joe Burrow injured and had a number of other injuries. It wasn't because they weren't good as a team. So I'm anticipating that they'll bounce back with a healthy Burrow. Yeah, I don't know. To me, the most volatile team is the Jets in terms of how good or bad they could be. That distance between what their potential final record could be is most vast for me. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud now. Now I'm getting to all kinds of NFL season hypotheticals that we are months and months away from diving into. But
well, I love them. I love them, though.
Yeah. But we are not months away from diving into the draft. In fact, we're 2 weeks away starting today. We got a new draft profile coming up, taking a look at the defense at noon. We're also going to hear the latest from Uchenna Nwosu talking about what feels different for the Seahawks defense coming up at 11:45. Before we get to it, you're listening to Bump and Stacey on Seattle Sports and the Seattle Sports app. One NHL team is reportedly in talks to relocate. It's not as bad as it sounds, though. Don't go anywhere.
This is The Timeline
with Bump and Stacey.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
This is The Timeline. It's me, Michael Bumbus. Our girl Stacey went downstairs for a little sniggity snack, and she ain't back yet, but now she's walking through the door right now. And we're going to start this thing with our guy, O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson passed away on April 10th at the age of 76 after a long battle with cancer. Stacey, I didn't even know that he had cancer.
Well, I don't know how many people knew. I think his family released this information once the news came out. I mean, I don't know if this was like common knowledge that anyone else had.
No idea. I saw videos of him, and I felt like maybe he was losing a little bit of weight. But I thought, oh, that's what happens when you get up there in age. And my grandparents lost a bunch of weight. But when I found out, it started to make more sense to me.
Yeah. Can I say something complicated?
Sure.
This is one of those stories where you hear it, you're like, how do I address this? And I'm telling you right now, the Heisman Committee posted out like our deepest condolences, blah, blah, blah. And they're being like ripped apart from it. I wonder if they shouldn't have posted anything.
OJ is such a tricky one.
That's what I'm saying. It's a very, very complicated legacy that he leaves behind as one of the most impactful athletes.
You understand that on the field, he was ridiculous. I think in 14 games, he at one time held the rushing record as far as yards in a season. He was a broadcaster. He was in movies. He's one of the famous commercials of him running through the airport, jumping over luggages. My grandma loved her some O.J. Simpson. But then you go off the field type stuff, and come on now, black community, we know he did it. We know he did it. So
yeah, OJ did it.
It's weird with him, because if you separate him, I think you can appreciate one part of him, but it's hard to separate him because the other part is so bad that they go hand in hand.
Exactly.
Bump, you grew up in the LA area around this time of the trial of the century. Do you have any lasting memories of those years?
I remember watching the Bronco go 45 miles an hour on the highway.
Like live on the news? You were
live on the news. We're all watching it. I remember when it was all said and done, people used to drive by the crime scene all the time. We had family come in from Mississippi, from Michigan, Tennessee. They want to see the crime scene of where, you know, that the whole
Brentwood.
Deal went down. Yeah, Brentwood. I also remember right after, maybe a few years after the whole trial went down, I went to go see a movie at a movie theater, and you hear people just gasp. I'm like, what's going on? I look at OJ, and if you've seen OJ walk, he's got a certain walk that he has, and you know that is him. And I remember just being scared as a kid, like, Mom. She goes, nah, he's fine. And I go, Mom, but he probably killed his wife. What's up? So they're vague because I was still a bit young. But, yeah, I remember being in L.A. when all that went down.
Mm-hmm. Next up here, the Arizona Coyotes. I always say Coyotes and Coyotes, and then I mix them together because sometimes I'm not entirely sure. I got to be vulnerable
with
you guys.
It's Coyotes.
The Arizona Coyotes are reportedly in advanced talks to relocate to Salt Lake City for this upcoming season, 2024-2025. They would play at the Jazz's home arena, which only has a seating capacity of 12,000 for hockey. The league said to have two drafts in their schedule for the upcoming season. One has the Coyotes staying in Arizona, and then the other has them playing in Salt Lake.
Salt Lake City. So I just looked up some NBA numbers when it comes to Salt Lake real quick, just to see what type of support that these guys get. And they're 14th when it comes to attendance in the NBA. What, 700,000, over 700,000 fans showed up. They're supported, and I've been to Salt Lake City, and I think they're serious about their sports, but if it feels like a loner, I mean, that doesn't feel like they'd be too attached to them.
No, but I mean, you also have some renovations that you need to make to that stadium and figure stuff out.
I think they would want to build a brand new stadium in Salt Lake, but the Jazz owner, I think, wants a lot of public money for it.
Well,
but
12,000
seats at a basketball arena is more than the, 5,000 that the Coyotes have right now on the campus of ASU.
That's all they said, 5,000?
5,000.
Yeah.
It's like when the Chargers played at the LA Galaxy's stadium for all those years.
Whose situation is worse, what the A's are going through or Arizona Coyotes?
A's.
A's for sure.
Not even close. Yeah. I don't know whose situation is worse than the A's, to be frank. And Arizona's not in like a great one in terms of their fans and the NHL being able to watch those games.
Never really got off the ground in the Phoenix area, whereas like the A's have had World Series champion teams in Oakland. They've had stadium sellouts,
yeah,
even at the Coliseum, like before they really put their foot on the gas pedal to move.
It's like when Levi Weaver was on with us yesterday and we asked him what he thought about the A's, and I'm paraphrasing Bump, but he was like, one of his biggest pet peeves is this idea that, like, well, you know, when it's the A's, they've always been bad. And he's like, there are diehard fans, there is a culture, there's an entire not only a community around the team, but a real history there that matters. So people trying to pretend that the version of the A's we've seen when they've been bad, or maybe a pluckier underdog team, to pretend that's all they've been does a complete disservice and lets Fisher get away with completely demolishing an entire culture.
Facts. Well said. I mean, when was the last time they were really competitive, Curtis?
The A's?
Yeah.
I think 2021, they made it.
Right?
It wasn't
that
too long ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They had, you know, Matt Chapman, Matt Olson on those teams. Like, they were really good for a few years there in the early part of this decade.
Next up, Mariners broadcaster Aaron Goldsmith nearly caused an international incident by losing his passport on the day the Mariners were leaving Toronto. According to the picture posted by Gary Hill, fellow Mariners Radio Network broadcaster, Aaron appeared to have found his passport while on the tarmac as the entire Mariners traveling party was boarding up for their return to Seattle. What if we would have lost Aaron to Toronto forever?
That is a stress.
It's kind of like locked up abroad.
kind of like locked up.
You know what I mean?
Like, we how long does it take to get a passport?
I don't know. A long time. We would have had to
had one, it takes a few months to renew it. But there's ways to get him across the border. There are ways to get him across, I'm sure.
Are you saying we should have gone across the border to smuggle Aaron Goldsmith back into the States?
That's what you're saying we should do, Aaron Goldsmith?
Are you crazy?
I'm saying that.
Are you crazy? Do you want to go to a Canadian prison forever?
I'm saying I was employed in Canada and may have misplaced my passport, and I had no issue getting across the border.
Bump.
Legally.
You legally crossed the border from Canada into the U.S.?
We're the radio.
Bro, right you just admitted that to a lot of federal agents that are listening.
Come get me.
That's crazy. Someone said you guys peep in the Astros score.
They're down 9-0 in the first inning.
Ooh, you hate to see it. You absolutely hate to see it. Someone said, what? Down 9-0 in the first 11 hits. Now I'm assuming the other team has 11 hits. It'd be great if they had 11 hits and hadn't scored a single run. I would love that. Let's see. We have time for, let's get to one more here. The Celtics and Bucks set some wild history Tuesday night, when they combined for the fewest free throws ever in an NBA game. Just two, shattering the previous record of 11. Boston became the first team ever not to attempt a free throw in a game. The game finished in under 2 hours with only 12 total fouls called. Jaylen Brown was the closest to fouling out. He only had 3 fouls against him.
This is exactly what I imagine when I hear dads and moms scream from the bleachers, let them play, ref, let them play. This is letting them play. I didn't watch the game, so I can't tell you how physical this game was or if it was at all. But I don't know how to feel about this, because when they call too many fouls and there are too many free throws, I'm mad. And now there aren't enough free throws. I'm like, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. Who had money on the game? What was the spread, over, under? Like, holla at me, because this don't seem right, especially for the NBA. You got Giannis play.
He did. He shot the only free throws.
Oh, that was from Tuesday. I was going to say he's shut down.
He played in this game. He was the only person to shoot free throws in this one. It kind of reminds me of like pickup basketball, where it's like call your own fouls, and not a lot of fouls get called unless it's like a blatant elbow to the jaw or something like that. But yeah, only 12 fouls between the two teams. I don't know. I kind of like basketball without tons of whistles. It makes for a good pace of the game.
Very okay with
that. Not a lot of stoppage.
Yeah, I see that. I didn't cover Giannis's injury at all, which I feel like maybe I should have mentioned there. My bad.
It's all good.
Well, he shut down just for the rest of the regular season, not the
exactly.
rest of the season.
Exactly. Because he didn't actually tear his Achilles. Did you see someone saying, like, what an injury for a Greek person to... We are taking a look at a potential draftee for the Seattle Seahawks coming up at noon. Going defense for that one, and we're talking about the Seahawks defense before then. Don't go anywhere.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on Seattle Sports.
Here are your hosts, Michael Bumpus and Stacey Ross.
We have a new Seahawks draft profile coming up at noon. Before we get to it, the latest from another Seahawks defender, this one already on the team. It's Uchenna Nwosu, who's returning to voluntary offseason workouts and expects to be ready by the start of training camp. He was dealing with a torn pec that cut his season short. And, you know, Bump, at the time when Uchenna went down, we were thinking, well, you know, you've still got Boye, you've got all these other pieces. Who needs to step up in the absence of Chenna? And I don't think we realized it at the time, though certainly do in hindsight, how impactful he was and how important he was to that defense. So let's take a listen to some of what Chenna had to say about where the defense could be going.
I would just say just like it just being like a breath of like fresh air, you know? You know, the last 2 years are kind of frustrating. Well, not the last 2 years, but maybe last year was kind of frustrating, you know? And sometimes when you get change, you know, it can bring out the best in everybody. You know, I see a lot more smiles on people's faces. You know, people they're more happy. They're more energetic, I feel like. And I don't know if that's just because it's the new year, new season, but, or it could be, you know, coaching changes and new opportunity, you know, but everybody is kind of coming along together and, you know, everybody's talking more, everybody's hanging out more, and I feel like it's bringing the locker room closer.
Feels like a breath of fresh air in that building, and here's what he thinks about McDonald's defense early.
No, it's still, you know, early on, so I'm still learning more about his defensive philosophy, but I don't know, just the amount of complexity, I guess, in a way, but in a good way, you know, different ways to get after people. I guess it's just mindset going forward, what he wants done, you know, it's very clear, and I like that.
I am curious, Bump, before we get to this other Chinnicutt about how he fits, how Uchenna thinks he could fit in. I am curious about what Mike McDonald's defense is going to look like, because the number one story once the season starts will be, is the defense better or not? This is why Mike McDonald's here. Is it better or not? And I'm wondering how these players respond, how they fit, how it all works out.
I think they will be better. And I don't think they'll be better week one. We see drastic changes, and they're going to be the number one defense through the first quarter of the season.
That's what you think.
I don't think that's going to go down.
I don't either.
But I think that you got to look for little improvements, being a little better against the run, just being better tacklers. Having the right personnel out there. Now, obviously, Clint Hurt, he knew what he was doing. He doesn't have the wrong guys out there. But it's just the fundamental things that you're looking for initially. Then once they've established themselves fundamentally, align, assign, execute, they can do all those things, then you start to get a bit more creative. Now you learn your personnel a bit more. You understand who Uchenna really is. You've seen film on him, but getting to know him, how he thinks, coaching him up, getting him to execute. Then you start to really start to evolve your game plan, because the guys are showing that they can handle the fundamentals. Okay, now let's get after it. So it's up to the coaches to get the players ready for that evolution, but it's also up to the players to get these coaches to believe that they can handle a bit more, because he's not going to throw the whole playbook at them to start. He's going to lay down the foundation and then, okay, guys, show me what you can handle, then I'll open this thing up more.
Let's talk about what Mike McDonald does and doesn't have to work with, starting with Chenna.
It fits my skill set because, you know, it's something that is kind of similar, not to last year's scheme, but in terms of, like, you know, where I'll, you know, what I'll do, what I'll line. You know, I'm an athlete. You know, I pretty much can do anything. And so no matter what system it is, honestly, I feel like I can do well in it. So his system is just going to elevate me to another level, and I just can't wait to see it.
I love that confidence. I hope we are all so confident. Bump, I'm going to ask you to put yourself in Mike McDonald's shoes, to pretend in this moment you are Mike McDonald. You are not Mike Bumpus. You are Mike McDonald.
Okay.
And you have shown up to Seahawks headquarters and you are taking a look at your team. And you know the team you just came from and the weapons that you had and what you had to work with. And we don't know exactly who he wants to be as a defense, but you know the weapons he had. If you're Mike McDonald, when you survey this defense, when you're out there at these voluntary workouts and when you're looking at your roster, do you have the pieces you need? Like, what's working? What's intriguing you as Mike McDonald?
One, Leonard Williams is locked down. You got your dude in the middle who's going to be a tone setter. But I think you're looking at the edges and saying, okay, there's room for these guys to be dynamic. Boye Mafe is coming off his best year as a pro. Only been in the league 2 years, but he's getting better. You got Uchenna Nwosu, who I think this defense in his absence realized how important he is. I think they knew how important he was schematically, but emotionally, who Uchenna is. He is the spark plug out there. He's the guy who's hooting and hollering, emotional leader, getting guys going. So I think he's looking at this defense and saying, all right, what are the strengths of this defense right now? It's the edges. It's the secondary. What am I trying to figure out? Linebacker play and that defensive line. Leonard is going to be fine. I think Jay Reed is going to be fine. But what exactly am I able to do? Because he's coming from a situation where you had Matt Abuke, who had, 13.5-14 sacks. You have Van Noy over there. You got Clowney. It's just a different personnel. You see who guys are on film, but it's different when you're at practice with them every day. You're having these conversations with them. You're talking about game plan and understanding what gets them going and what they're comfortable doing. Now it's your job to set these guys up. So I think he's looking at the defense and saying, I have some pieces to work with. I don't really know until I get out there. Mm-hmm. Even during training camp, guys look good, man. Shoot, McIntosh looked great in training camp. We still ain't seen him. So it's realizing who you are at this point and understanding, how do I get my guys to perform to the level that I need them to perform at, and what are they capable of? What are they comfortable with? It's a dating game right now. They're dating each other, trying to figure each other out. Right now, it's all good. Everyone's smiling in the locker room. Yeah, I bet. I bet you're smiling because it's different, and you know you have to put your best foot forward. You have a first impression here with this staff. Mm-hmm. Some of these guys are guaranteed to be here, and they ain't worried about that, but they still want to get off on the right foot. So, yes, honeymoon period right now. Get a 300 rushed on you for 1 week, and then we'll see what changes are made and how guys are feeling. Hopefully that doesn't happen, but that's worst case scenario.
Now, the answer has changed a little bit since they've added Dodson and Baker, and since they've added to linebacker. Is there a shopping list that you create? If you're Mike McDonald, you go here. Do you look around at this team right now and go, ooh, if I'm going to make this cake that I want, I really need this ingredient.
Yeah, for sure. And that's why you sign linebackers to one-year contracts, because you're saying, I think this is going to go well. I think this is the guy or one of the guys that that could help us go to that next level, but I'm not sure. You know where you're sure at? I think you're sure on the edges, even though you can go get some more edge rushers. I think you're sure in the secondary at your corner spot. I think you're good at one safety spot. You're trying to figure out who the new guys are when they come in, what they look like, and should you draft another one? There are a few teams that you look at every single spot and say, I'm good to go. And the Niners are one of those teams. The Chiefs are probably one of those teams on offense, even though they got to get better at the wide receiver spot. There's always some tweaking going on. But, yeah, those are the spots I think he looks at and says, okay, we're good. We can still get more depth. But the middle of the field, the LB spot, is where he needs some more ingredients.
All right. Well, is that new ingredient on defense going to come to the defensive line? Are we looking at linebackers? Are we looking at edge rushers? Are we looking at safeties, cornerbacks? Who are we looking at? I will tell you, we're looking at defense when it comes to pick number 16 for the Seahawks. Our Seahawks draft profiles continue next. I am not saying this is going to be a high mock, a high pick. What we're looking at is who might be the Seahawks' first pick off the board, and we have a name that you're going to recognize. It's a name that'll be a little controversial, but also one that we're going to talk about as a potential fit for Mike McDonald's defense. Don't go anywhere. Those draft profiles continue next.